listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
September 1st, 2018. I hope that everyone has an enjoyable and safe Labor Day weekend. I actually went into labor with my first child on Labor Day. Not going to tell you the year, but I reminded him this morning of that fact when I was talking with him. Anyway, if it's going to be Labor Day, then you might as well go into labor, right? This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. As always, I invite you to visit and subscribe to the following websites: SpingolaSpeaks.net, WoolliesBlog.blogspot.com, and ScreeningSandyHook.net. We will not be taking email questions today. If you have a question, post it in the chat room at spingola.chattango.com. Of course, we will take calls in the third hour. You may view our guest lineup at spingola.com. In addition to the links for each guest, I also have other interesting links relative to the guest or his or her subject. As I mentioned, we will take calls in the third hour at 800-313-9443. I've had a heck of a week. I'm not using a microphone today. My main computer that I use for my broadcast had fan failure, and so it's going to be fixed this week. So I had to kind of, well, I brought a laptop upstairs and hooked it up to the printer, and it didn't like my mic. So if I sound a bit tinny, that's why. I don't have a mic on and I feel kind of naked without it. Anyway, I have a bit of a rant about something which I have strong feelings. I received an email newsletter from the Village on Friday in which they announced that they would be conducting their mosquito abatement program Friday night. And I hope that you will seriously think about responding to your local authorities if they are exercising or conducting mosquito abatement programs. But anyway, this is what I said to them. And I quote, "Why does the Village insist on spraying for mosquitoes when there are relatively few people who experienced West Nile virus, which is rarely deadly? The same spray that kills mosquitoes also kills the butterflies and the bees, insects that pollinate fruits and vegetables. The spray permanently disrupts the ecosystem. There are many ways that people can protect themselves from mosquito bites, just as they have for decades. The state of Illinois has experienced a huge number of bee colony collapses. If the spray is dangerous enough to warn people who have respiratory issues to close their doors and windows on the night of the spraying, then how much more dangerous is the spray to birds, small animals, including pets, and insects? Please note that the wide variety of birds that we used to see in our yards and parks has dwindled. The only benefactor in this situation is the chemical companies that make this noxious poison." I really get very upset about the fact that they do this all over the country without any regard for what they're doing to nature, to our environment. Anyway, enough of that. My guest today is John Dietrich. He is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet influence on American post-war policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's nice speaking with you.
Well, it's very nice to speak with you. I love your book. It's wonderful. I thought it was really funny in the first part of your book. You were talking about thanking your staff. And I thought, hey, he's got staff? How did he get staff? And then you were being facetious because you didn't have a staff. And you acknowledged the fact. Well, here's what you said. I would like to thank the universities that assisted me in my research, my staff, and the archives that opened their doors to me. Unfortunately, I cannot. The manuscript was created from open sources available to any conscientious reader without assistance. So I just thought that was really funny. I do love your book. It's a wonderful book.
Well, there's a definite advantage being on your own. I don't risk losing my job or coming out with an unpopular thought. A lot of historians are under pressure to modify history. And I want to make clear right from the start, this is not an anti-American book. There's a school of history that's popular nowadays that any blemish, anything done by Americans that might be criticized is put up front in the schools to teach Americans how bad they are. This is about the progressives that were running the country in the 40s, and this is the origin of a lot of the deep state. The book puts a lot of emphasis on an individual by the name of Harry Dexter White. He was one of the most important people in the 20th century. Nobody knows who he was. He was the creator of the modern global economic system, the father of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And I've asked quite a few people from both of those organizations if they knew who he was, and they didn't even know. He was a founder of their organization.
Wow. Now, you said that you didn't have to worry about being fired. So are you retired?
I'm retired. But I wrote this book while I was still employed.
Uh-huh.
And I don't hesitate to speak my mind, and it probably accounts for my lack of, I didn't go up in the chain of command like I could have. I had the potential, but I was a little too critical of things.
What about friends? Have you lost friends or relatives over your views?
Very few people. I've discussed this with a few people, and very few people have any clue. I was just reading an article from the head of the Heritage Foundation on how wonderful we were, following the Second World War. We were just, very generous, and that was not actually the case. I mean, what was done was it was a crime. It was a crime against humanity, and it was designed by White to be that way, in the hope that Europe would go communist. He was a Soviet agent of influence, and his design was to destroy the economy of Western Europe. And he almost succeeded. By 1947, Italy and France were on the verge of electing communist governments. And that's what motivated us to come up with the Marshall Plan.
Well, the Marshall Marshall Plan too was actually kind of a situation where we would lend, or the United States government would lend money to various countries to rebuild, but then they would have to work through specific contractors, pretty much the same as they do in Iraq and other places. The Marshall Plan was not of great benefit except to the people who were awarded the contracts. In other words, you go in and you destroy a country, and then the people with connections to the U.S. government can go in and presumably build it up again, or at least collect the money for building it up again. Isn't that correct?
Well, actually, more important than the Marshall Plan was the fact that Joint Chief of Staff's Directive 1067 was replaced. You know, this was basically the Morgenthau Plan for the, which was imposed on the U.S. zone. And, it restricted trade there were all kinds of things that were designed to destroy the economy.
That's true. Including.
So once those restrictions were lifted, they had the economic miracle.
We were told that. And I think too that we were really told what to think about the war, because there was a lot of programming, propaganda, the newsreels. It was supposedly the good war, and we went or the United States and its allies went in and they destroyed those horrible, horrible Germans, and we had a lot of propaganda, and of course.
Oh yeah. I got a quote from Eisenhower. A continent has been liberated from all that is an antipathy to the ideal of democracy, which is our common heritage. Of course, you know, the Soviets gobbled up half of Europe, and of course he included them in the democracies. And current common heritage. You know, Life magazine came out with an article that essentially said the U.S. population and the Russian population are essentially the same. You know, we're just like them.
Well, didn't he backed off and allowed the Soviets to come in and take land that they shouldn't have? Well, the word that they used was liberate. Correct?
Yeah. They liberated Eastern Europe.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, there's a lot of evidence. Well, certainly the U.S. military could have taken Prague. I mean, there were a number of places that we relinquished. We allowed the Soviets to take Prague and Vienna and Berlin. And it's quite possible that we could have taken those capitals. We could have ended the war a lot sooner than we did. The Morgenthau Plan was described as psychological warfare in reverse. I mean, we made it clear that the Atlantic Charter was not going to apply to Germany and that we were going to enslave their people. And this is... there's an author, John Koster, who covered this. There was a Soviet agent came to the U.S. and met with Harry Dexter White and provided him with an ultimatum that was to be given to the Japanese, which would precipitate a war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I lost my train of thought right there. And,
of course, they had sanctions against Japan for quite some time, and Japan had a lot of money in this country and depended on imports to even run their economy, and
they had
sanctions. Did you find
it? They had them thoroughly blockaded. I mean, there was no chance You know, they had to surrender, and they were willing to surrender. You know, a lot of things are coming out now, you know, this is 70 years later, that have been suppressed.
Right. Well, they surrendered in December before they dropped those two gifts on Japan. They already surrendered. Yeah. And they surrendered to and used the same criteria that the U.S. government later gave to them, but the U.S. government would not accept their surrender agreement in December because they had these bombs they wanted to test.
Well, the Japanese wanted to retain their emperor. You know, supposedly this was unconditional surrender that we insisted on. We got it in Germany, and we're going to do it in Japan, too. And there was a condition. They wanted to retain the emperor, and they were allowed to. And, you know, one of the other benefits of prolonging the war was allow the Soviets time to move into Manchuria and Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked up several hundred thousand slave laborers doing that, and got arms to provide to the Red Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, these things were, there were people in the United States government planning on this, working for the benefit of the Soviets.
Right. There was Whitaker Chambers, who was a Soviet agent. And he claimed that FDR was merely a puppet, and that a group of communists were actually running the country. And this group included Bernard Baruch, Samuel Rosenman, Raymond Moley, Felix Frankfurter, Henry Morgenthau Jr. and Sr., Harry Dexter White, who you've mentioned, Alger Hiss, Benjamin J. Cardoza, Charles W. Taussig, Nathan Margold, and on and on and on. Well, Roche Schneiderman, Isidore Lubin, just a whole bunch of people that were running things. And FDR was just, I refer to him as the red in the White House.
Well, you know, he was sympathetic. I mean, he may have been a puppet, but he was sympathetic with this group.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, one of the fascinating things I learned in my reading is that, you know, he was arrested four times by the Germans. Had you ever heard of that?
No.
Yeah, he was arrested and I think it was in the course of 1 or 2 days. And of course, you know, it was in his youth, and he was, you know, he was a young American, thought he was a big shot, and, you could get away with everything or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilhelmine, Germany was a very strict place. And and that might account for his dislike of the Germans.
Hmm. Well, he came from a family that had the same mentality for quite some time, going back.
Yeah.
To the early 1800s. Huh. So what was he arrested for? Just being obnoxious?
I think one incident was, you know, he was passing an orchard and he was helping himself to some fruit. And, you know, I mean, and nowadays a kid doing that, you know, if the police were to see that, they'd say, hey, cut that out, move along.
Sure.
But in that society, you know, they didn't tolerate any type things.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the, that was before when, in the 20s?
You know, it may have even, you know, I'm not sure of that. I'll look that up. It's in Peterson's book on Germany. And let's see.
Oh, I think we're, is that our music? I think we're going to a break. No, we are.
Oh.
Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. guest today is John Dietrich, and he is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. He also was very instrumental in the Middle East also. He was kind of a scoundrel. Anyway, John's website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com, and his last name is spelled D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. If you just say diet rich, that's a good way of remembering how to spell his name. Let me just share something from the chat room. Life is a dream for the wise, a game for the fool, a comedy for the rich, a tragedy for the poor. I had mentioned earlier that I'm wearing a t-shirt that says, rich people start wars, poor people die in them, and their children pay for them. So I think that's pretty apropos. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Okay. We're talking about Roosevelt, and you mentioned that he had been arrested, and of course there were other people you mentioned Eisenhower, who absolutely detested the Germans, and it wasn't just one German, it was all of them. And of course he's famous for the encampments, over 200 encampments that he built, where he, you can't say that he housed German prisoners because there was no buildings. They were out in the environment, rain, snow, heat, no water, no food, with just a big ditch, that they were supposed to use as a latrine. So we don't hear too much about that, but we hear about other things. Anyway, why don't you pick up where you left off?
Well, mentioning Eisenhower, he turned over several hundred thousand German POWs to the Soviets as a gesture of friendship. Now, these people were, supposedly we adhered to the Geneva Convention. And, yeah, I know. And, you know, you laugh, but this is really a tragic event.
It is.
It makes no sense to abuse your opponent unnecessarily, because he's just going to fight harder. You know, word got out. Now, of course, a lot of this stuff was done once the surrender was done. So, the Germans couldn't retaliate. Yeah. But of course the Japanese could. You know, the Japanese were watching what was going on in Europe, and they had, plenty of communications with Europe, and one of their reasons for to fight to the death. Why what have you got to lose? You know, if you're going to be enslaved, or even worse.
Right, that mentality. That's how they, some of them became kamikaze pilots, and they were willing to give up their life for something more honorable.
For their country, for their wives and mothers and daughters and
exactly.
Others, you have to admire them in a way. I mean, they were fighting for their country.
Sure they were.
And like an American would,
Right.
There are examples of people who died, given up, jumped on hand grenades or whatever, and we admire those people.
Now you mentioned that Eisenhower had turned over a lot of POWs to the Soviets. They were also using them in France and in Britain to do dangerous work, such as locating mines and dangerous work, which is also against the Geneva Convention that you already mentioned. Which is also, it's horrendous. terrible. Okay. Yeah, but I think through the break, we'll be right back with our guest. And our guest today is John Dietrich. He is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. According to the Labor Department, about 11 million people were out of work when FDR took office. He installed radicals, Fabian socialists, Stalin apologists, and communists in his administration. In addition to the Soviet communists, Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor were friendly toward the Chinese communists. Harry Hopkins, an FDR advisor, influenced significant decisions and policies. He represented Bernard Baruch and the International Jewish Banking Cartel. From 1937 through May 1944, Hopkins and Baruch were in continuous communication. So we see the beginnings of the Morgenthau Plan, which I hope that we can define exactly what it is. Horrible, horrible plan. But anyway, please continue. John, are you there?
FDR made a statement in October 1944. The German people are not going to be enslaved because the United Nations do not traffic in human slavery.
Oh, never think of it. My goodness, the UN is just such a humanitarian unit. Oh, my goodness, they would never allow trafficking, sex trafficking, organ trafficking. Why, they're just the world's policemen on all this horrible stuff that could happen. They're just a terrific entity. Baloney.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the Morgenthau Plan, the memo given to FDR, one of the points is restitution and reparations. D, by forced German labor outside Germany. Now, this was incorporated in the Yalta Protocol. And the second provision there is reparations in kind is to be extracted from Germany in the three following forms. And C was use of German labor. Now, General Patton wrote in his diary, I'm also opposed to sending POWs to work as slaves in foreign lands, in particular France, where many will be starved to death.
Right.
James Bakke wrote a book about this, and he was vilified by Stephen Ambrose, who's probably the premier historian of that time. And it's funny, the Eisenhower Library, the director of the Eisenhower Library has called out Ambrose as a fraud. He said a whole bunch of stuff that was not true about his relationship with Eisenhower. But Bakke claimed that the French and the U.S. had starved to death approximately a million POWs.
Right.
And Ambrose disputed that. Now, my research, you know, and I'm an amateur, actually, you know, and I don't, like I said, I don't have a staff, but I come up with at least 350,000 people missing. You know, we had an agreement with the French wanted 1,700,000 POWs. And we were supplying them, and it was coming out that they were looking like, after a while, they looked like Dachau inmates. Yeah. So they put a stop to it periodically, you know, for a short time, and then restarted it. And we were supplying these slaves to the French. And the British, you know, the British had 250,000 slaves. You know, they, Churchill was against it.
Oh, I'm
sure. Natalie, when Attlee took over control of the British government, they started using, well, they had the slaves already, but they started, they kept them for I don't know how many years.
Yeah, Churchill is such a stellar person.
Yeah.
I'm facetious.
The point I was trying to make was that there are when they return the Secretary of State Burns made an agreement for the release of these POWs, and you know he came out and said it's regrettable that thousands of people are still in enforced labor, and he didn't say slavery, he said enforced labor. And he said thousands. Well, actually, at that time, he made that statement, there were 4 million people in slavery. And they were used to clear mines. So there's an excellent movie that was put out not too long ago, A Land of Mine. And it's about these kids who, you know, towards the end of the war, the Germans were desperate. They were... They were enlisting children in the Wehrmacht. And, so they had these kids and they were using them to clear mines. And, you know, it showed the fatalities and, you know, and of course, as you know, it was against the Geneva Convention.
Right.
It's a powerful movie. And this is another, you know, years ago, this movie would not have been produced. But as people are, you know, less indoctrinated with the propaganda, they're willing to look at stuff like this.
That's true. And of course, the internet has a lot to do with this.
Oh yeah, you know, that's why the internet has to be shut down. You know, there's a big move to, you know, censor people on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, social media, for hate speech. You know, what we're doing right now is hate speech. You know, this is, the left cannot tolerate the openness. Because they have so much to hide.
Well, whether it's the left or the right, I think both the left and the right have a lot to hide. And I don't believe in censorship, even for people like Alex Jones. If people want to listen to him, they should have the right.
Right, nice. But there's a big move in this country. You know, of course, you know, try to get a speaking engagement on a college campus. That can't be done anymore for conservatives.
Well, that's true. Of course, the educational system is under the U.S. government. Even private institutions are funded by certain people with objectives.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, everybody has an objective. You know, we, but it's, you know, some of the objectives are pretty objectionable. But like I said, you know, there's a lot to be, a lot of bogus history. And I'll give you an example. There's a professor, Jeffrey Orlick, and, you know, he may still be at the University of Virginia. And he wrote a book, House of the Hangman. And he says, Harry Dexter White was accused in 1948 by Joseph McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Affairs Committee of being a Soviet agent. Now, on the face of it, that's an idiotic statement in the first place. It's senators don't have House committees.
And that's...
Now, the funny thing about this was this factoid was repeated by Bill O'Reilly on his program. Yeah, you know, he's supposedly a history buff.
Big mouth, isn't there? Big mouth.
Well, I think it was Ann Coulter he was interviewing and Ann Coulter informed him that senators don't have House committees. And certainly McCarthy was not doing this in 1948. Now, and that's what we're up against, you know, historians that, are intentionally distorting the record.
Sure. And that's always been as soon as they, when Rockefeller and Carnegie took over the educational system of the United States in 1906, when they actually created the Department of Education, they planned to distort history. You distort history and you can rewrite and do anything that you want. And when you distort history, you can also create your present and work from there. Based on false history, a false narrative, you can pretty much get away with murder, slaughter of people in a lot of countries. And now it's interesting that the United States had severed diplomatic relations with Russia on December 6, 1917, because the Bolsheviks had refused to honor debts that the Tsarist government had incurred. Henry Morgenthau and Dean Acheson, both Felix Frankfurter proteges, invited Maxim Litvinov, who was born Litvinov Finkelstein, to the White House to finalize recognition of the Soviet Union with FDR, something the Soviets had sought for 17 years. So we see right off that as soon as FDR took office, 1934, one of the first things he did was recognize the Soviet Union. And that really tells you what his objectives were. You were mentioning...
He chose Morgenthau to work out those negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, Walter Duranty was also involved in that. Duranty had just written stuff for the New York Times covering up the Ukrainian famine.
Yes. Oh my gosh. The lies he told, he should be hung. But hopefully it's not the place now that he's resting in or burning in.
His plaque for his Pulitzer Prize is still hanging in the New York Times' lobby or wherever they keep those plaques.
I'm not objective here. It just infuriates me what has happened to various countries, to the slaughter and numerous lands.
The number of people killed in the last century is just incredible. Just incredible.
Yes. Yes. In the wars, 100 million people. And of course, what did Stalin say? One death is a, what did he say? But a million is So, which tells you what kind of person this is. But, when you think about FDR, he was supposedly from a wealthy capitalist family. He created and transformed America into a communist state. He legitimized the Bolsheviks after they had plundered Russia and starved and slaughtered millions of Russians. I have no respect whatsoever for FDR or other members of his family.
He was a criminal. I mean, the things that he did were just criminal. And I found this thing on him getting arrested. It's in Peterson's The American Occupation of Germany, Retreat to Victory. It's on page 21. And he says, based on his experience in Germany of Kaiser Wilhelm. So this is before World War I, such as being arrested 4 times in one day. Yeah. And he doesn't give the circumstances.
Well, he's an arrogant American who thought he could do whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted, and it didn't work for him.
Well, unfortunately, he didn't serve much time.
Right. And then, of course, you...
And again, I don't know what he did.
Okay, so let's talk exactly... excuse me. What the Morgenthau plan... was.
Well, it was a plan for the occupation of Germany, and it had all kinds of provisions in it. And one was the slave labor. Another thing was the intent to starve the German people. The original, before Morgenthau was involved in this, the original planning said starvation should be prevented that might endanger the occupation forces. And once Morgenthau wrote it, actually White, it said starvation would be permitted, unless
wow.
it, you know, was really, the U.S. troops were in danger. So.
Well, starvation was a really big factor after World War I in Germany. Okay, we are at the top of the, no, we're at a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Today is John Dietrich. He is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. Alrighty. So, there were some books that came out, and we talked about before or after World War One. I think that of World War One and Two, there was just a short break so that the Allies could rearm themselves and develop weapons and bombs and such. And that's what they were doing. Meanwhile, while America and Britain were spending money on warfare, on creating more warfare, and while America was really in a severe depression, and people still had outhouses and standing in soup lines and pretty much starving, people in Germany were building railroads, they were building highways, they were building buildings, and they did it all without credit. It was kind of an amazing thing. And in 1918, Morgenthau's father was a political appointee, and he wrote a book describing the Armenian genocide when he was a U.S. ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And that's also something that people rarely hear about, but I did mention that earlier, that he was really one of the people that influenced the Ottoman Empire breakup, including the genocide of between 1 to 1.5 million people. And, of course, the newspapers didn't say a whole lot about this. But anyway, talking about the Morgenthau Plan, you said that one of the factors, one of the things that they were going to include was the starvation and the slave labor. And they did not feed their slave labor well, or house them well. And anyway, there were some books that were written before the war, before World War II, that talked about that were really propaganda. And one of them was written by Theodore N. Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, and he wrote this book. And there was it was called Germany is Our Problem. And it was kind of interesting because Germany was busy working on their country. They had no intention of engaging in war. And Poland, the Polish actually did sorties over German lines 8 times or more. And Germany did not respond. But anyway, let's talk about what else the Morgenthau Plan included.
Well, it also included the ceding land to Poland and the Soviet Union and the ethnic cleansing of Eastern Europe. And this is one of the, this is an incredible,
most basic history,
you know, the greatest movement of people in the world.
Have a bit of both. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
The author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. And I was talking about the book. I mentioned the book, Germany Must Perish by Kaufman. And it's very interesting. And you mentioned Japan before. And Germany and Japan were partners. They collaborated. They had an agreement that if one was attacked, then the other would come to its rescue. And so when the American government put sanctions on Japan and just forced them, literally forced them, to make some sort of an attack, then of course that brought America into the European war.
Well, that was the plan, yeah. That, the Roosevelt administration was doing a lot of provocative things to, you know, like giving the 50 destroyers to Britain and, firing on submarines and what have you. And the Germans just wouldn't be provoked. So they figured, well, let's see if we can go the Japanese route. And that was where this, guy Popov, met with White and gave him instructions for this, a memo to FDR about, having the Japanese evacuate the Chinese mainland. And the Soviets knew, of course, that the Japanese would not do that. So, you know, it was going to provoke a war.
Right. And of course that's, it took several years of sanctions and finally Japan responded. And, of course, Churchill and FDR tracked the course of the Japanese from the time that they left Japan to Pearl Harbor. And in fact, they had moved some of their better ships from Pearl Harbor and sent them.
Well, there were four aircraft carriers assigned to that fleet, and none of them were in Pearl Harbor at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they were, you know, they were out for various, you know, excuses. But, and I think Roosevelt was willing to sacrifice American lives. We knew. I mean, the code was broken. We knew the Japanese were headed for Pearl Harbor. And, but he didn't realize how efficient the Japanese would be. I mean, they did quite a bit of damage.
Right.
And I just ran across this quote, Vladimir Kopov, stated that Stalin was the real initiator of the ultimatum to Japan that provoked the war in the Pacific. You know, it was given to White, and White turned it over to Morgenthau. Morgenthau turned it over to the president, and a lot of the language in the ultimatum we gave to the Japanese came right out of that memo.
Hmm. Interesting. Hmm. Did you want to mention the Atlantic Charter?
Well, of course. I mean, that was before the U.S. entered into the conflict. Churchill and Roosevelt met and proposed this Atlantic Charter, which was how wonderful we would treat our enemies if we defeated them.
Yes, and of course they heeded that as much as they did the Geneva Convention.
Of course. Right. Well, it was eyewash, you know, it was propaganda. And,
sure.
It's like his statement saying that the UN doesn't deal in human slavery. I mean, the Russians, they were part of the UN and they had been dealing with slavery for several decades.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And of course we could go back several decades and talk about slavery in this country, but that's we haven't covered that. The slavery is something that's been going on for some time. In 1941, Bernadotte Schmidt of the University of Chicago was talking to an audience, educators, called the Allied officials to starve 330 million Germans. That was what they decided that they wanted to do. And the article was in Collier's Magazine, which had a circulation of 3 million. And there was also an article by Emil Cohn called How to Treat the Germans, which included the idea of isolating Germans from everyone backed by a law that would forbid Germans from leaving their own country. And of course, that's, go ahead.
Well, there was Herbert Hoover, and eventually, you know, when we just when we decided, hey, the Russians are not all that wonderful, and we may be headed for a Cold War with them, we figured, hey, we better rearm the Germans. And so we begged them to rearm. But prior to that, well, Hoover went over to Germany to rectify the food situation. And one of the statements he made prior to that was, there is the illusion that the new Germany left after the annexations can be reduced to a pastoral state. It cannot be done unless we exterminate or move 25 million people out of it. So that comes close to that 30 million figure you were talking about.
Right. And that was, I think there were probably 60 million Germans at the time. And that was, so what they're saying, what they promoted, was the idea of killing half the people in the country. And,
you know, and they did, I mean, it's just monstrous to me. I mean, it's almost inconceivable to me that someone would allow an infant to starve to death. I mean, that, only a monster could do that. And it was done, I mean, the infant mortality rate in Germany in 1945 through 47 was, it was horrendous. It was incredible.
It was also after World War I, people were living in cellars, starving to death. Many people starved to death. And so this is a long-term project or plan to destroy Germany. That started in World War I.
Yeah.
And then you had the Versailles Treaty.
Today, you know, Germany will not be around much longer. You know, another, I don't want to give any kind of rough idea, but, you know, it's, when you have a people, you propagandize a people and tell them that they're worthless, or a menace, and they actually believe that, they're not gonna, they won't survive. And I think they're doing that here in the U.S. too. And, you know, the people, there were a group of people that worked in the Office of War Information.
Right.
And they came back and they ran the U.S. media.
Right.
Now, William Paley, and, you know, there were a whole bunch of them that were working to promote this idea of collective guilt, and when the war was over, after the occupation, there they came back to the, you know, run CBS and NBC, you know, all these major networks.
Right, and they're still they're still promoting the idea. I think there's a new movie out. I don't know the name of it. They're still making movies about those horrible Germans.
Well, on a year, you know, there hasn't been a year gone by without at least one movie about the Holocaust or what have you. And, you know, I think one day in the life of Ivan Ivanovich or something like that, it's one of the few movies about the Soviet gulag. I don't know any movies about the Chinese. The Chinese, you know, in 1978, the Guinness Book of World Records had a category for major mass murderers. And Adolf Hitler came in third. And that was the last year they had that category in there. Somebody must have called them out and said, hey, we're not in, you know. So Mao Zedong was the champion. Stalin came in second. And Hitler was a lousy third. And they decided not to publicize that anymore. And if you look at the number of movies made about Mao and Stalin and Hitler, you know, there's a big discrepancy. Excuse me?
They're practically non-existent.
Yeah. Germany was essential to the economy of Europe. And when they destroyed it, all of Europe had to go down with it. And it's, I got another quote here. This, in 1946, this Max Forrester is the chief of the military government's coal, division. Yeah, so what, he asked this guy, what did the Germans do to get efficient production from forced labor that we are not able to do with Germans working the mines? And, this guy replied, they fed their help and they fed them well. You know, we expected these people to mine coal without feeding them. I mean, does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you brought up Herbert Hoover. He was in charge. He was in China, and he was responsible for sending, 200,000 Chinese slaves over to, can't remember where exactly in Africa, but to mine. And, he was in charge of this. And they were told that they were going to have these wonderful jobs and they were going to be earning money and all this. He's just a bit, and this thing about the food, he made food available so that Germany would continue to fight. It was, and he made money. Anything that he touched was designed to make money. It wasn't designed as any humanitarian effort. He began working for a particular group of people right out of college. And, he was something else. Now after May 8th, after the end of the war, actually the end of supposedly the bombing and everything else, that already destroyed the country. They bombed every city that, had over 50,000, and then they started bombing, smaller towns. So they literally tried to wipe Germany off the map, as far as their infrastructure and everything else. And then the occupiers were going to replace all the German teachers. They wanted to replace the educational and communication systems. And that is how they probably indoctrinated many of the Germans, as you imply that they did. That Germany, they feel this guilt because they were told that they did all these terrible things. But it's very interesting that if they supposedly did all of these terrible things, that hardly anybody knew about these terrible things. Was it a big secret? I'm not sure. But, it's very interesting. And so
that's a big criticism of the Germans. Of course they knew, this terrible thing was happening. Of course they knew it happened. Well, they didn't have a free press. And if you talked out of turn, you were in danger.
Really?
In the United States, we supposedly have a free press. And all these things transpired and Americans don't know about it. So what is our excuse?
Well, most of the book burning occurred by the Allies. They went into Germany after the war was ended and they burned everything that was printed pre-1933. And, so it was the Allies that did the book burning. It wasn't, the Germans. And the reason that the Allies were out to get Germany is because Germany kicked out the bankers. They rebuilt their country after World War I without any credit, without having to borrow money from the bankers. And if they could do it, they were an example for every other country in Europe. So they had to destroy, not only did they destroy the economy and the infrastructure, but they also had to give them such a black eye, in the press and create these fables about what they did, so that the only thing that people would remember about Germany was the Holocaust, quote unquote.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the bombing, and the bombing of civilians. 80 to 85% of Germany's machinery plant was survived the war, but the housing really suffered. Victor Collins, he was a Jewish publisher, British publisher, and he did a lot of humanitarian work. And he said of the 5.5 million pre-war dwelling units in the British zone, 1,600,000 were totally destroyed. This was the target, and it was targeted by something called the Lindemann Plan. Frederick Lindemann was an advisor to Churchill, and he advised him to bomb working class housing because they were close together. And so the target was the civilian population, not the industry. And if you can read anything, everything says, we had strategic bombing and, we were bombing these different plants and what have you. They were bombing civilian neighborhoods.
And
not only that, I'm going to try a quote here from General Chuck Yeager, a great test pilot, great American. And he wrote an autobiography, and in it he says, "We were ordered to commit an atrocity. If it occurred to anyone to refuse to participate, nobody refuses, I recall, that person would have probably been court-martialed." And what the atrocity was, refugees fleeing a burning city like Dresden. There were thousands and thousands of people fleeing with their, and most of them were women and children. The fighter pilots were instructed to mow them down.
That's right. And they did the same thing in Japan. As you say, they had what is known as a scorched earth policy. And, which is, horrific in that you attack citizens, civilians, which is the most egregious thing. And it's something that the U.S. government has continued to do in every country that they enter, where they want to instill democracy. And you mentioned some of the machinery and whatnot, because Germany was very progressive. They're very intuitive. They're quite a brilliant race of people, and their discoveries and inventions are wonderful. And a lot of their buildings, businesses, were dismantled and taken into the Soviet Union, where they were washing their potatoes in toilets and whatnot, because there were some parts of Russia that were, they just didn't have it together. They were,
this was studied. You cannot, this dismantling program, it was bogus. I mean, it was a destruction program. It wasn't reparations. If you pick up a factory, say an automobile factory in Detroit, and you move it to El Salvador, well, you need resources, the raw material to, for the steel and whatnot. So it's an extremely complex system. You need the people with the knowledge to run the factory, and you need the supply lines to provide the part. Those maybe 10% of those factories that were disassembled were ever of any use whatsoever.
Right. Unless you have the wherewithal and the knowledge to operate advanced machinery, then it's just going to get rusty and not be of use to anybody.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, they commented these factories were, the parts were on railroad sidings and just rusted.
And of course the Germans fought a defensive war, because the Soviets were right there on their border, prepared to attack when Hitler decided to go on the offensive. So if you really look at the actual facts of the war and what happened and read some of the things that you've read, then you get a different viewpoint. And you mentioned Patton, who was killed, who was murdered, because of, he said that we were fighting, on the wrong side. And he was going to come home and he was going to tell people that we were fighting on the wrong side. And he was going to spill the beans on what, Eisenhower did. And, so. That was pretty bad. Pretty bad.
And this, you know, we're living with this today, you know, the results of this. An incredible loss to civilization. I mean, the West has just about exhausted itself doing this nonsense.
Yes. We certainly lost the wealth of a nation is arrived at or is prompted by the production, by production. And when you look at what we are producing, all the production has gone offshore, most of it.
Yeah.
So, you're just not going to make that much money flipping hamburgers or selling insurance. I don't know about the insurance, but there's just so many service jobs that you can do, where you're not engaged in producing something that somebody needs or wants. So anyway, Morgenthau, presented this policy for post-war Germany, and he presented it to War Secretary. I like the way that they called him War Secretary instead of Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. Defense, yeah.
Right. When? How is that applicable? Secretary of Defense? Really? Anyway, Henry Stimson and John J. McCloy, and the plan was that they had this special committee composed of Morgenthau, Stimson, Harry Hopkins, and Cordell Hull, and they met with William Bundy. To decide how they were going to divide Germany and to determine how to proceed with criminal charges against Germany's leaders, and also to talk about Morgenthau's all-encompassing deindustrialization plan, because that's what they, you mentioned this before, that they wanted to get rid of all the industry. Which is what has happened here in this country, without an internal war.
Yeah.
We've been deindustrialized. So FDR wanted to punish the Germans, and as you said, he didn't like Germans, and of course Eisenhower didn't like Germans, and so, together they were going to make sure that the Germans really were, they would suffer, and they would not only be defeated, but they would have to be engaged in slave labor, and that they would have to have this collective guilt placed upon them, because he figured the whole The whole nation was engaged in a lawless conspiracy against the decencies of civilization. Can you believe that? But
most people did. I mean, and if you repeat things often enough, people will swallow it.
And that is true today. We certainly have been, we have really, it's very sad, that the educational system is no longer effective. Most people in America, as you say, if they hear something often enough, they believe it. They don't use their head to think about the things that we're told. I was having a conversation this week with somebody, and it doesn't relate to World War II, but I said, so you believe that an aluminum airplane could fly into a steel and concrete building and make the entire building, 101 stories or whatever, fall to the ground in a pile of dust? You believe that? Just on the surface, an aluminum airplane. And we've all seen aluminum airplanes. They're all made of aluminum. We've seen them crash into a fence and get scratched up and bent and everything. It's preposterous. And yet people believe what they're told if they hear often enough, and particularly if they see images, the imagery. But you can apply this to so many things, so many topics.
Oh, wait, you know, another thing that helps is have a scientific expert, a guy in a white coat.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
You know, that's,
with a stethoscope.
You know, if he says it, it's got to be true.
Right. Or have an actor. We had just recently, we talked with Clint Richardson, and he had all these images of, he wrote an article and had all of these wonderful images of people who were promoting Camel cigarettes and doctors, actors dressed up as doctors. We are all impressed with authoritarian figures, authority figures, teachers or principals or people who have authority, or we presume to have authority. Okay, I think we should take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. The author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. We were talking about Germany and some of the post-war kinds of things. The other thing that I noticed, and I'm sure you probably did too, is that right after World War II, that there were a lot of offers made to people, particularly to leave Germany and go to Canada, where there was lots and lots of land and lots of opportunity. Have you heard this also?
Well, I know there was a lot of immigration. A lot of people left Germany. A lot of them went to South America. These were valuable. It's like today, you know, the farmers in South Africa are extremely productive. They're hardworking. They're knowledgeable about their field of work. And, you know, you could drop them in the middle of Saudi Arabia and, 10 years from now, there'd be, valuable farms there. I mean, they're hardworking people and they have ingenuity. So they would be an asset to any country.
That is true.
Well,
but I think, too, they wanted to get the younger generation out of Germany so that that younger generation would not retaliate in some way, because they knew, I believe, that they had suspicions about what had happened. And they were a force that the Allies did not want to deal with. And so various countries offered immigration and cheap land.
Yeah. But again, these were, more than likely, they were going to be productive citizens.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And staying in Germany at that time, up until 1948, you would risk starvation. I mean, this was a definite policy, and it's been covered up, but,
and they didn't want them to be in Germany. They wanted them to be, not be productive in Germany, but leave the country.
Yeah. But then, you know, after a few years, when we realized the Soviets were, not going to be cooperative, I've got a quote here. One of the British politicians said, and we literally begged the Germans to rearm. And this was, you know, even before the war was over, supposedly Churchill, had the troops in Norway, imprisoned, but he kept their weapons nearby for the possibility if, you know, the conflict with the Russians were to start up right away. And, you know, I don't know how true that is because, you know, there's so much propaganda and nonsense about this period. You can only believe half of it.
Well, you also have to consider Lend-Lease in this whole thing, that when you think of all the financial support, machinery support that the United States gave to the Soviet Union, that's amazing.
Well, Harry Hopkins was running that show, and you know, I'm sure you've read Major Jordan's diary about, we gave him, uranium and, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they offered, they even, floated money through Britain, through the Lend-Lease, as much as $6 billion. And, so you have to ask, who's behind this? What's going on here? And then, there was another guy too. After Morgenthau announced his plan, there was a fellow by the name of Raphael Lemkin, and he'd written a book called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. And an interesting book, and he later talked about the genocide convention and what constituted genocide. But that's another topic that probably do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I haven't researched that.
Yeah, but this Lend-Lease, my gosh, it was welfare for war. We'll give you a bunch of money, and with all this money, then you'll be able to fight a war against Germany. And in fact, there was the FDR administration enacted the Lend-Lease Act on March 11th, 1941. And the president could then lend or lease war materials to supportive nations like Britain. And yet that was before we entered the war. And we're supposed to, and America was supposed to be neutral. And yet they offered.
Yeah, that's a violation.
Exactly.
Supposedly. Yeah.
Yes. Terrible. And of course we know about Attorney General Robert Jackson, who played such a part in the Nuremberg trials. Right?
Yeah.
Piece of garbage he was.
He, according to Peterson, Peterson wrote a book about the post-war situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, Jackson demanded the military property officer acquire 2 grand pianos for him. And, you know, this is, he's black marketing. You know, this guy is supposedly, a great jurist. And Peterson remarked that no records were kept of these pianos, how they were obtained and how much it was paid for them. He took them back to the States.
Oh, that was very common. That was common for a lot of people, from captains on down to filch property and send it back home. And in fact, they had stores of property where people could just go in and take what they wanted. And they also had, places of, how do I put this gently? Places of entertainment where soldiers could meet women. Houses of
because of the economic policy that White instituted, women would sell themselves for a chocolate bar. I mean, it was incredible. One of the things, the Russians paid the equivalent of $1,000 for a Mickey Mouse watch. You know, this, and that's because of the financial system that, to start at the beginning, Harry Dexter White made it possible for the Soviets to have a set of plates to produce occupation marks. And they just cranked this stuff out like crazy. The U.S. printed something like 10.5 billion marks, and the Russians put out 78 billion. And that was free money to them. They gave it to their troops, and the troops would buy a Mickey Mouse watch, giving the GI $1,000. The GI would take that to the post office and ship $1,000 home.
Right.
And there's a story here about a bunch of congressmen went to the went on a mission to Germany and said they were given post exchange cards, which allowed them to buy anything they wanted at the local PX. They would load up their suitcase with cigarettes. And on at least one occasion, a very prominent congressman asked me, "Tell me where this black market village is." And he headed straight for it. I mean, that's the kind of corruption. And, a lowly private, could make more money than he's ever seen, with a little bit of effort. And he, in a way, you couldn't blame him.
Right. There was also rampant rape, in France by the American soldiers and in Germany. And if you were a German who engaged in such behavior, you were immediately disciplined, harshly.
Yeah.
But,
the thing is, and Eisenhower condoned this,
As he should. He was too. He had Kay Summersby. Yeah, he had a wife at home and a mistress in Europe.
Yeah. That's something I've read that the French, there were, many of the French were complaining they preferred the German occupation to, the indiscipline of the U.S. troops.
And for what reason? For the fact that
the rape and looting. I mean, France was supposedly an ally, and the troops were in there, and they were not disciplined.
Right.
And you can say you can criticize the Wehrmacht for whatever reason. But it was the most efficient military. And if you want to be efficient, you have to be disciplined. And they were allowing rape does not allow, it's not a disciplined army.
Right. Well, there was a graffiti in Berlin in March 1945 that said, and a quote, "Enjoy the war. The peace is going to be terrible." And
it's true. Yeah.
Yes. Very true. And Ilya Ehrenberg said, "The Red Army is burning to light the capital of the Germans as a fire signal of revenge to Berlin. These words raise the dead. These words mean life. Soldiers of the Red Army, the hour of revenge has come," unquote. And they were out for revenge, and they raped everybody. Women.
Yeah, that
children,
includes
80-year-old.
That includes Russians. I mean, they didn't discriminate. POW, or the slave laborers, they came through there, and if it was a female and male even,
Yes.
Yeah, I got this quote from Eisenhower, and in August he remarked to a press conference, "In many ways, I feel our soldiers are very good ambassadors in teaching the Germans about our way of living. For example, their lack of discipline shows in other people not used to that sort of thing how we act and react." We would ask you not to quote lack of discipline. I mean our attitude towards discipline as opposed to a subservient race. So, he thought it was a positive for to have a lack of discipline. And the thing that distinguishes an army from a rabble is the army is organized, it's disciplined.
Right. You certainly.
And of course.
Go ahead.
Well, you're talking about the Soviet army coming in and raping. Up to a million Soviets fought for Nazi Germany. That's an incredible. I mean, this is Solzhenitsyn saying this, that it's. There's no record in history of this happening. According to the Nazi doctrine, you people are inferior and we're going to exterminate you when we have an opportunity. And the reply is, well, that's all right. You can exterminate us, but give me a weapon now so I can, kill some communists, kill your enemies. I mean, it's insane.
Right. And you can certainly tell a person's character, a man's character, by the way that he treats people that are at his mercy. And certainly that was the case in Germany. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very high. And this was also a result of Eisenhower allowing the Soviets to liberate, quote unquote, certain areas so that they could exercise this opportunity to plunder and rape the Germans. Because they had been propagandized by this individual, L. Ehrenberg, and they wanted revenge. And they schooled the Soviet soldiers to take this revenge. And they also, Eisenhower had under his command the French colonial troops. And this group of people raped about 2,000 German women just in one community, Stuttgart. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. He's the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. And we were talking about rape. And one of the things that politically, sexual relations between a conqueror and the vanquished suggest dominance and submission. And it certainly puts the men of a country, even in France, who was supposed to be an ally, by having their women raped by the Allies, it compelled the French men to basically acknowledge their decreasing power. And the Stars and Stripes, which was a newspaper produced by the U.S. government, it was a propaganda piece, and they all but encouraged this kind of behavior. And the other thing that happened was that the females that were raped often suffered from venereal disease, pregnancy, and it was really another way of bastardizing the German race. And it's just terrible. Terrible. Your comments, please.
Well, you know, the Wehrmacht, I'm sure, I mean, there were examples of rape by German soldiers, and I suspect they were severely disciplined for that.
Oh, they were, absolutely.
Yeah. Also, in the POW camps, I've read that women who were in Soviet and German camps, there was no sexual humiliation in the German camps. I mean, it was just not done. I guess, you know, maybe because they were prudish or whatever. But I mean, it wasn't done. And in the communist camps in Poland, Czechoslovakia, this was part of the routine.
Right.
Now, I've got a quote here from Vasily Grossman, who apparently he was a Jewish, a Russian Jew, and apparently his family was wiped out by the as a result of the war. You know, I don't know if they were, you know, in a building that was bombed or if they were killed by the Einsatzgruppen or whatever. But Grossman recorded the complaints made by Ukrainians. And in quote, in these villages, the Germans used to relieve themselves in the holes and on the doorsteps, in the front gardens, in front of the windows of houses. They were not ashamed of girls and old women. While eating, they disturbed the peace, laughing loudly. Their gluttony, their ability to eat 20 eggs in one go or a kilo of honey in a huge bowl of shmedna, provoked contempt in the peasants. And I, you know, that's a hell of a complaint, but I didn't see anything here about genocide or rape or, you know, any of this stuff.
Right.
They were crude, according to the Russian peasants.
Hmm. You're right.
It's a peculiar complaint.
It is. Couldn't have made up something more imaginative. We'll be right back. It's the top of the hour. We will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
And our guest today is John Dietrich. He is the author of The Morgenthau Plan and the Soviet Influence on American Postwar Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. I would like to share a quote with you from the notorious Ilya Ehrenberg, and he said, and I quote, "The Germans are not human beings. From now on, the word German is for us the worst imaginable curse. From now on, the word German strikes us to the quick. We shall not get excited. We shall kill. If you have not killed at least one German a day, you have wasted that day. If you cannot kill your German with a bullet, kill him with your bayonet. If there is calm on your part of the front, or if you are waiting for the fighting, kill a German in the meantime. If you kill one German, kill another. For us, there is nothing more joyful than a heap of German corpses." Now, Ehrenberg was the propagandist for the Red Army, and he was in charge of poisoning the more uneducated Russian troops against the Germans by exposing them to a lot of pictures of unnamed Russian POWs of the Majdanek concentration camp. I know I blew that up. In the Polish city of Lublin. Now, when the Soviets invaded Germany, they raped the allegedly superior German women initially as an act of vengeance. So they were propagandized as well as the Americans, who listened to Stars and Stripes, or read Stars and Stripes. And rape was something that was promoted. It's just pretty awful. And as you said, they even raped Russian women who had been released from German labor camps.
Well, you know, also the revenge excuse doesn't hold up for Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and, you know, the other East European countries that the Soviets liberated. There's a book by, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but Milovan Gilis, who talks about the Russians coming into, they came into a small section of Yugoslavia, and they raped all the women there. And that was, and the Yugoslavs were supposedly their allies.
Right. It's just amazing to me. And also the American GIs, were led to believe that French women were very easy, and they were immoral and promiscuous. They had no moral shame. And of course, they didn't speak the same language. And so there was a lot of rape in France, and when the GIs liberated, quote-unquote, France in 1944, there were a lot of pictures taken of soldiers who were surrounded by French women who were hugging them and smiling. So it produced the idea that the women were ready for the men to come in. And Mary Louise Roberts wrote this remarkable book about the experience in France. And her book is What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France. And this was published in 2013. The other book that is very interesting is Gruesome Harvest, The Costly Attempt to Exterminate the People of Germany. I'm sure you've read Gruesome Harvest. I believe you mentioned that book.
Yeah. Well, there's many books coming out now. I mean, I first published mine in 2002, but there are quite a few coming out, and they have more and more, they're exposing more and more of what took place. And you know, some of them are not all that helpful. There's one very well written book, and it's well researched. And he makes three references to Elsa Cox and her lampshades. In the war. Now, this has been proven time and time again that this is a bogus claim, but
Right. Here's
a historian who's repeating it.
Right. It's that old adage that if you hear it numerous times, then you believe it without even looking it up to see that it's actually a big farce. And
but, if you're researching something, and you're this guy's a legitimate historian, how can he continue something like that?
He's probably a historian after the Carnegie faction of history. I'd say the one thing that Thomas Goodrich in his books talks about, not only did they rape German women, but they also mutilated them. And left them where they would remind other women of the savagery that awaited them. They would nail them to doors. They would hang them from trees. They would disembowel them. His books would just bring you to tears. And Thomas, or Mike.
It makes you think about human beings, what kind of, savages we are. I mean, animals don't do these kind of things.
Right.
One of the famous incidents was the liberation of Nemersdorf in eastern Prussia. They have photos of the people who are mutilated and that particular incident, the Russian soldiers shot some 50 French prisoners of war. This was a mob. The Russian, and there were some Russian generals who knew how destructive this was. I mean, if you want to win a war, and this is one of the reasons a figure is quoted endlessly, 26 million Russians died during the war. Well, how many of those Russians were killed by Russians?
Right, because there were a group of Russians who, when they came into Germany, decided that they were going to fight alongside Germany. And then they were forced to go back by the U.S. Army, by the U.S. Government, and they would rather be dead. Many of them committed suicide because they knew that what they faced when they went back would be worse than death. And so many of them off themselves.
Well, one of the great tragedies, can you imagine, Cossack women throwing their infants into the Elbe River?
Yes. Well, okay, we have, I knew Werner would call. Let's take our good friend Werner from Canada. Werner, welcome, dear.
Yeah, dear, good evening.
Hello.
Good evening.
How are you?
We are getting it from all sides here too. And,
yeah.
We just want people to wake up. It is not just only unique here in North America, here in Canada. It's all over Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, the people, they have woken up. They have seen the real face of communism. And they have built up resistance against it. But here in the West, the people, most of the people are still being bullshitted by the propaganda. And unless they wake up, I think there won't. I don't see much hope. Hello?
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It is a sad thing. And as our guest was talking about the mutilation and of people and people throwing their babies into the river to save them, or otherwise. I was thinking of abortion in America. That's pretty gruesome, to kill your own child in the womb.
And what is being done with the aborted babies?
Yes.
Who run the abortion clinics? Here in New Brunswick, it was a Dr. Morgenthaler.
Hmm.
You know, and I think the name says it all. And they're making money with it.
And they're using aborted fetal tissue for, well, they put it in vaccines, they put it in flavorings that people use in their food, or that corporations use to flavor food. It's so gruesome to even think about what, oh my gosh.
Anyway, I think now more and more of the information is coming out, and the lies don't fly anymore. And over the last few years, a lot of information I got, especially from RBN. I'm asking now the question, in Revelation it's talking about the beast, the two-headed beast. And I come pretty near to the conclusion. Could that be the Anglo-American Empire and the Zionist Empire, the two-headed beast, when we look at all the atrocities that are being done?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And I think the people who believe in the Lord, and they shall go with a fine-tooth comb what the preachers and the pastors tell them in church, and they shall do their own research and wake up. You know, basically they have created in the so-called Western world, they have created countries where the people have become specialized idiots, and they are the perfect subject for a super dictatorship because they don't dare to question the ones in power.
Right, we're a dumbed down nation, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Bless your heart, Werner.
Yeah. And may the Lord protect you, Diana, and your guests, and all those that are seeking for the truth, and those that speak out against all the lies that are being peddled nowadays.
Well, thank you, and bless you.
May bless you
so
all,
much.
Too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
One of the individuals I believe you mentioned him before is Alfred Maurice Desaix. He wrote A Terrible Revenge, The Ethnic Cleansing of the East European Germans. Now, we know that there were a lot of Germans that were put into slavery by Britain, by France, by the Americans and the Soviets. But there were a lot of Germans who were living east of Germany who were told to get out of the countries that they had been living in for generations. And many of these people in their travel, sometimes with hardly anything but the clothes on their back, many of them were raped, brutalized, and killed on their way to Germany. And De Zayas talks about this, and it was an ethnic cleansing. And I think the figures are 10 to 15 million people. Is that what you would guess? John, are you with me? Did we lose John? Oh, okay. Great. There's another book, After the Reich, The Brutal History of the Allied Occupation. It's a good book. Another good book is Sexual Violence in Europe in World War II, 1939 to 1945. Now, in the Bible, you find a lot of this kind of behavior that when one group would go in and war against another group, they would take the children as slaves, either sex slaves or slaves, period, and they would rape the women. And apparently that's part of war. And it certainly was a part of war in Europe with the Allies. And also in Japan, there was a lot of promiscuity, and it was pretty bad. Another book, The Fall of Berlin, 1945, by Anthony Beevor. And I really recommend Mary Louise Roberts, the book that I mentioned before, What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France. And that came out in 2013. Now, we all remember that the liberation photo, which was probably, well, it was in Stars and Stripes, and they published it, and it was, the newspaper actually made its debut on November 9th, 1861, before or during the Civil War. So it's an old, old newspaper, and it was put out by the Defense Department. And they started publishing that paper in Europe in 1942. And, of course, the staff was very biased. And they had an embedded staff that would create these photos. And the newspaper men would be in uniform, and some of them would be soldiers. But one of the liberation photos that is most renowned was the photo of the Marines planting the American flag at Iwo Jima. And that appeared on the front cover of Life magazine. And Life magazine came into being November 23rd, 1936. But Eisenhower actually requested Stars and Stripes truthfully report about the war to engender confidence in his command and the way that he and his staff viewed events. And he was a real stage manager. And he often created media events for maximum benefit. And so the Stars and Stripes were always the newspaper people around Eisenhower were always ready to make these photos look legitimate and appropriate to whatever was going on. And they had a propaganda vehicle, and it published, well, all these happy women, and particularly in Normandy, and all these children. And anyway, it is just amazing about the propaganda during the war coming from the U.S. government. In addition, we also need to remember some of the news flashes, the newsreels I guess they had a lot of these during movies or in the middle of movies. And of course, they were all propaganda. And people believe this. And people believe something that they see more than something that they read. 75% of the population learn visually. That's why when you're looking at an advertisement on TV, whether you're looking at an advertisement where they're pushing some kind of drug, they always show the picture. Oh, okay. She is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Post-War Policy, and his website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. Do we have John back, or?
I'm back.
Oh, good. You disappeared. Did your battery run low, or?
No, I have no explanation. It's just cut off.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm at like 80%.
Oh, okay. Gosh. Well, somebody, I don't know. But we're just happy to have you back. That's for sure.
I'm glad to be back.
I was talking about Stars and Stripes, and they used these female Hollywood pinups to try to portray what America was fighting for. And that was a determination to keep women smiling, satisfied, and happy. And so Stars and Stripes, with its photos, eroticized patriotism and heterosexual expressions and connected sexual exploitation with American war objectives before the United States invaded France to consummate a consensual union. That is what they did. And, of course, all the...
No, you know, this...
Go ahead.
It's been a transformation in society. You know, the professional military, I don't know when it became acceptable to be raping your opponent's women. Certainly the wars, you know, like say the Russia, the Franco-Prussian war. I don't know. You know, and I suspect there was like one or two or three cases of rape there. I mean, men have been like that for forever, but I mean, it wasn't a policy in those professional armies like it is today, apparently.
Well, warfare has changed dramatically, beginning with the so-called Civil War, because what happened before the so-called war is that you would have two armies facing each other in a field of battle, and they would fight each other. But the Civil War, they attacked civilians, and they destroyed the food production. They destroyed farm animals. They slaughtered anything that was in their field, anything that was in their way. They burned buildings, and pretty much that is what they did in Germany. It was a scorched earth policy, and the German civilians, they were very deprived. They had little food, and what food that they did have, the Soviets seized and hauled it away in trucks. And so the civilians had to rely on whatever food they had stashed or what they could find. And so when you couple that with rape and war and occupation, and rape is never about sex, but it's always about power. It's to terrorize, dehumanize, subjugate female citizens in occupied areas. And it's an act of aggression that has nothing to do with sex. And men rape in such circumstances because they can, without experiencing any consequences. So, and this was, the Allies did this against all German women and girls. Even the French talked about the excessive violence by the American troops. So, and I mentioned when you were gone that there are stories in the Bible that talk about going into an area and enslaving all the children, either for a slave or for whatever reason, and raping all the women. And that was, those were biblical times. Gosh, when you think of today's looting and raping and it's going on not just in Germany. It didn't happen just in Germany. It happened in Iraq. It happened in the Middle East. If you read the book, Afghanistan After Democracy, some of the stories that are in that book talk about the women. And it's really a way of dehumanizing a country that that has been taken over. They get rid of the artifacts, cultural artifacts, museums, anything to destroy the culture, but they do leave the movie theaters open just so that they can show pictures, motion pictures to debase whatever culture they happen to be shown in, like in Afghanistan. They would show movies that had not been a part of their culture. Movies that, demoralizing movies, movies that showed violence against women.
Yeah.
Gosh. And it really says a lot about people, soldiers.
You know, I was in the military. I had 21 years in the military. And the people I worked with, they were human beings. And some were pretty lousy and some were really exceptionally good. But it's the organization itself, the culture that's created.
Right.
Your superiors will let you know what you can get away with. And if they're saying, well, you know, if you want to rape women, you know, they might guess. It's the leadership, it's a corrupt, a progressive, corrupt leadership is what we've got in this country. And, you know, I give you an example. Here in CBS 60 Minutes, May 12th, 1996, Leslie Stahl asked Albright, you know, Secretary of State Albright, we've heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it? And Albright responded, I think this is our choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it. You know, they killed, you know, apparently, you know, you can never know for sure. 500,000 children.
Arena commercial
liberation. Excuse me?
I'm wondering if we're in a commercial break. I hear somebody in the background there. Of the Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Postwar Policy. His website is johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. And anyway, we were talking about rape and you were talking about Madeleine Albright and what she said about the 500,000 children who had been murdered. Well, they died because there was only 4% of the electricity still available after the bombing. All of the electrical power was out. The the water became foul from sewage, and so that's they died. And she said, "Yeah, it was worth it." What was she thinking? If 500,000 of our children were slaughtered in such a way, or perished in such a way, what a horrid woman! What a horrible piece of garbage! Not even going to refer to her as a woman.
Well, you know, I think people rise to the top. All right. They have to have something wrong with them.
Psychopath.
She was highly willing to stab people in the back and, you know, claim other people's work as her own. And that's how she got to where she was. And it no heart whatsoever.
You're right. Absolutely, you're right. And, the things that they did in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, you were talking about how if you get some good, educated, skilled farmers, that they could make literally the desert bloom like a rose, that you put them in a desert and they could make things grow. And that's literally what happened in Libya, where they created a wonderful place where they had reservoirs of water, and their country was very, very forward and very progressive. And that's what they did. They went in and destroyed that because you really can compare countries in the Middle East with Germany, because they suffered the same fate because they resisted the world's banking authority. They resisted change. They were living in countries. They gave their citizens, the residents of their countries, were benefactors of the resources of their country. It wasn't being siphoned off by U.S. or multinational corporations. The people who were residing in those countries benefited from the resources of those countries, which is normal. That is the way that it should be. And they had so many advantages that we will never see ever, ever in this country. Free education, help for buying a first house, just so many benefits. Just as a result of having a lot of resources, which they did, and to have
the progressive philosophy. I mean, do you see in Venezuela, you know, where they got them, Libya? They have photographs of before freedom and after freedom. You know, before they were liberated, you know, it was a prosperous country, and after liberation, it's trashed. Rhodesia, they had success in Rhodesia. Now the life expectancy has gone from the 60s down to the 30s. They're running out of rats to eat.
Oh my gosh.
They're pushing this agenda, and there are people in South Korea who support that knucklehead in the north. Now, unless that photo is photoshopped of the satellite photo of North Korea, of Korea, you know, you can see exactly where North Korea starts. There's no lights at night. I mean, and it's obvious that this man he must despise the Korean people to treat them that way, but he still has support in the South. Incredible. Just incredible.
It is. It really is. And as I said, you can compare all of these countries to Germany, who was also moving ahead. The people were benefiting from their labor. People, everybody had a car. They had vacations, yearly vacations. The owners of factories and the people who worked for them, they were friendly. They had a good relationship with each other. They didn't depend on credit and bankers. So it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Well, there's people, they're not happy with that. I mean, I guess, you know, it's part of human nature, possibly. If you see somebody who's doing better than you, to resent that. Now, I've never had that feeling, but apparently it's fairly common.
But I guess the more logical way of thinking was, if you see somebody that has excelled, it gives you the idea that you can also excel.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it, you know, where you can say, hey, I want to be like that person. Or another way to look at it is that person, it's not fair, you know, that he's successful and I'm not. And they don't put it two and two together that, well, he's successful because he worked. You know,
sure.
That's Obama coming out with that, you didn't build that or whatever nonsense. That's the psychology, and it's fairly common.
Well, with communism, everybody is poor.
Well, except for the elite.
Except for the elite. They will always have...
And knucklehead in North Korea, you know, if he wants, Johnny Walker, he just snaps his fingers, you know. Whatever he wants, he gets.
It's amazing. And as you say, to rise to the top, all you have to do is be a psychopath and stab
people. Exactly. You know, there are good people. I've worked for people who are really decent and hardworking, competent people, but there's far too many, especially in government. I spend most of my time in government, and I think if you're in charge of something, you want to promote somebody who's not going to outshine you and be a threat. You'd prefer to have some kind of a jerk. Supervisor.
I don't know. So, getting back to the plan. The Morgenthau plan. They want to deindustrialize and kill half of the population, and have others emigrate from the country who might be a threat. What else?
Well, the chopping off of East Prussia. You know, the Morgenthau plan was not as draconian as what actually took place. He did not recommend the dramatic transfer of territory that took place. But of course the ethnic cleansing, This is one of the most dramatic things is ethnic cleansing of Eastern Europe. And, there was an incident when a high Nazi official was assassinated in Czechoslovakia. And, the Nazis retaliated by, wiping out a village, and they they executed the males over 15 or 16 years old, and sent the women and other children to concentration camps. And they made a movie about this town, Lodz. And so, you know, people are well aware of that. However, there was another incident during the ethnic cleansing where quite a few more people were, they weren't sent to concentration camps. They were murdered right there, men, women, and children. And this is actually in Wikipedia, surprisingly enough. They mention the town and the massacre. And it's, I don't know how to pronounce this, Hornim Matrice or something like that. Hornimostenice. And they removed 71 men, 120 men and women, and 74 children from the train, made them dig their own graves, and executed them. No movie was made about that, though, because that was the Czechs doing that, killing Germans.
Okay, let's take a caller. Let's take Jenna in Washington. Jenna? Jenna, are you with us? Oh, okay. Thank you. Now, on April 9th, 1951, Life magazine revealed that Eisenhower used the U.S. military mission in Moscow to radio Stalin that he intended to stop his military campaign at the Elbe River in order to allow the Soviets to seize Berlin. And that was reported. And it's very interesting that Eisenhower's political advisor was Averell Harriman. He was U.S. Ambassador W. Averell Harriman. Received a memorandum and delivered it to Stalin. How's that? Oh, okay. John? John is
back. Yeah.
John? Yes.
John.
Welcome.
I'm here.
Okay. Welcome. No, there's a caller. Caller okay. from Washington? Do I have a caller from Washington? Okay. Okay. So we do have a caller so when he calls in, we'll take him. Okay, Jenna. Jenna is back. Okay, Jenna.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, great. I'm calling from the Pacific Northwest. And as far as the subject of resources and managing the resources all around us, like the forest, and I'm in a line of work doing local logging and utilization of lumber, and we can't compete with China and the products coming from China, and then the ability to at least make biochar as a garden amendment. Air quality restricts the fire department to even get a permit. And we've got wildfires. So as far as encouraging burn loads and people to reduce them and control them and just use fire, there's limitations even to that degree. A permit for a local sawmill isn't allowed. There's like just so many restrictions that we face. It's like you have to just live in a way that isn't sustainable, because the sustainability groups and Agenda 21 and all of those non-elected bureaucracies have this hand that it slows down production.
You're right. I have a friend a dear person who's been on my program, whose family was in the logging business. And because of the situation with bureaucracy and with the limitation on production, which is what you're talking about, you're not able to produce. And you talked about the fires. Are the fires a result of not being able to harvest a crop and it's overgrown, or what do you attribute the fires to?
Absolutely. In the public forest, Trump had a congressional meeting on the 16th, and the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zink, was saying, we haven't been control burning, reducing the fire ladders. This isn't about climate change. And in return, the media is bashing him and nitpicking him because he said those words. It's due to negligence. And Trump actually said, we are buying wood from Canada, and it's expensive. And it's like, with all the risk that you have to have the wood kiln dried and stamped to actually build with it. So what we can manage from dead and dying trees everywhere, it would be for a woodshed or a chicken coop or exterior.
Hold on for just a moment. We are going to a quick 3-minute break if you'd like to stay. Okay, so our guest today is John Dietrich, and he is the author of The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Postwar Policy. His website, johndietrichbooks.blogspot.com. So Jenny, you would agree that we are being deindustrialized in a different manner. But the result is the same. We're not producing anything. And your family is a direct victim of this policy, correct?
I absolutely agree. And I am so glad that you've interviewed Lark and Nikki on the past with the communitarian concept of how that plays into how it's been done to manipulate people's thinking.
Yes.
Accept it.
Absolutely. Yes, and Lark talked about communitarianism last week also, and people do. They accept it because we are dumbed down. We don't typically, the population does not think for itself, and thank goodness for people like you. Thank goodness for alternative radio so that we can talk about these things and talk and compare things that have happened in the past as well as what is happening now. We can make these comparisons, and they're absolutely a comparison. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Well, see, my grandparents in 1945 got ran out of Lithuania because their names were on the list, but they had to dodge the sweep so that they wouldn't wind up in Siberia. So, you know, this is my family line, and it's not very different.
Right. Oh, goodness. So that experience is helpful to you to understand what's going on. Wow.
Yeah, and how the family that we still communicate with, they can't talk about it. My emails to Lithuania and Latvia, they fall silent. And I wonder if they're censored. Because
I'm sure
I don't...
They are.
Yeah, because it's like I have half a family to tap in for more information, and I can't get it.
Wow.
And my parent and my mom grew up, we don't talk about it. My grandparents, we don't talk about it because it was so horrific. And the threat of they will put you in the gulag if you even talk about it.
Sure. Wow. Well, let's get in that way here.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Well, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I hope you have Lark on more because it seems like he's got a lot more to say on the subject.
Oh, I will.
Thank you. This is a wonderful interview. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Oh, that was nice. And I thank Jenna for calling in and making that contribution. So, John, we're out of time. If you've got some parting a parting comment.
Well, I appreciate you letting me have an opportunity to talk about my book. And,
you're very welcome.
I really appreciate what you're doing, and we have to keep this up. You know, keep alerting the people.
We'll do this again too. Okay.
All right. Very good.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, John. Take care.
Thank you. Hey. Bye bye.
Bye bye. And thank you so much, listeners. We'll visit next week. Bye bye.